From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm David Hyde in for Ross Reynolds. The Supreme Court ruled today that human genes cannot be patented, and NPR Science Friday host Ira Flatow is here to talk about that. We're also going to talk about how politics affects science and how science affects politics. Ira Flatow has spent his career trying to get more people to think about science, to understand science. Ira Flatow, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So let's start with the breaking news with the Supreme Court decision today that companies cannot patent parts of naturally occurring human genes. What does that mean?
That means if you discover it, and it's very interesting that Clarence Thomas wrote the decision. It was a unanimous decision, interesting for this kind of court. And he wrote basically, you cannot, but separating the gene from its surrounding genetic material is not an act of invention. Just because you can separate it doesn't mean that you can patent it. And so, but he also wrote, and they agreed, that if you then take the gene and make something new with it, which is what Myriad did, they also made this a cDNA. If you change it, then that's a product that you can patent. But this is a big, big, big decision.
Tell us about that. I mean, how is this going to affect the world of science, the world of business?
Well, when you patent something, the reason that, you know, patenting, people don't know, is actually mentioned in the Constitution and as a way of creating commerce. The reason why people patent things and are given the right to patent things is because they're going to spend money on developing it, and then they want to make it profitable to make a product out of it. So when you patent something, could be, let's say, a gene or something, you then can make a product out of it. But it prevents other people from using that same thing to make their own profit out of it. So if this gene had been patentable, then other people could not make other genetic testing tests like Myriad did in competition with them. So if you had to rely on just Myriad's testing, you couldn't, let's say you didn't believe that testing or you wanted a second opinion, you could not go to another company and say, hey, can you do the same test on me? Because, you know, that's a big decision I'm going to have to be making about breast cancer genes, let's say. I need to have a second opinion. Well, it was almost impossible to do that because they held the patent. They said they held the patent for that. Now the Supreme Court says you don't. It makes... That means competitors can get in. It could drive the cost of the actual test itself, which is $3,000, paid a lot by health insurance companies unless you're not insured. And it could bring competitors in and drive the cost way down. It also allows researchers at universities, at UW, anybody, and other places, to now look at that gene and study it more carefully and do experiments with it without having to pay a royalty or something if the gene had been patented.
So we're talking about this Supreme Court ruling today that companies cannot patent genes. And I'm wondering, what about there's some losers here. There's some people who feel like they should have been able to patent genes.
Well, I mean, that's the whole point. The point is that we might lose money. You know, this is, if it were patentable, we might be losing money because we won't collect royalties.
Does that mean they'd be less likely to invest that money in the future?
They might, but it might. But it'll open up the door to other people who could come in and say, look, now I'll find a way to make money doing that. We'll have competitors coming in and maybe spread the wealth around a little bit that way.
Science Friday host Ira Flatow is with us. We're talking about science news, science politics, science that's in the news. If you've got questions for him, you can give us a call at 206-543-5869. And you're in town to talk about Seattle's plan to become carbon neutral by 2050, right?
Right. It's one of our That's one of our topics on Science Friday tomorrow. People want to come down to the Pacific Science Center. We'd love to have them for a live show. And we'll be talking about your mayor will be one of our guests. And we'll also have Dennis Hayes on. And they're a good couple to put together, to very green people, talking about being carbon neutral, what the city can do, how can it influence the marketplace. We'll also be talking about acidification of the oceans. It's a very big issue right out here off of Seattle, and attempts to study what happens when all this carbon dioxide, you know, when you put it in the air, the ocean likes to suck it up. And when a carbon dioxide gets into the ocean, it turns to an acid and it acidifies, changes the pH of the ocean. And it makes it hard for some organisms, creatures, to survive there.
We just did a show yesterday, segment on that, about how it's going to affect young oysters. There's a new study out about that. But back to just carbon neutral. I think some people don't know what carbon neutral means exactly, and how you become carbon neutral.
Well, let's say that you you do something that uses carbon. You burn fossil fuel, something like that. And so you're going to be using up some carbon. Can you do something else that offsets that? that then is goes on the other side of the balance sheet so that it maybe soaks up carbon dioxide. So you create it on one end, you soak it up on the other end, or you will buy another product that is more carbon neutral. And so you have a balance sheet where it comes out to zero.
And that's part of how Seattle's going to try to achieve this. You've also written about the politicization of science and where and when the politicization came in. And because the science surrounding climate change has become so politicized, when did that start?
I thought, this is my own personal opinion, because I watched it happen in Washington when I was a reporter for NPR in the 70s. And I watched Jimmy Carter put solar panels on the White House, and then a few years later, when Ronald Reagan came in, he took the solar panels off the White House, basically saying, I think it was symbolic. You know, Jimmy Carter wanted to show you symbolically we should be investing in renewable energy. And as soon as Ronald Reagan came in, he basically cut out just about all the money for the programs. $350 million, he cut it down to $100 million, something like that, for the renewable energy programs. And I think getting rid of the solar panels was that sort of shot that said, this is where it ends. You know, we're not a society that has to deny ourselves these things. Whereas President Carter was just the opposite, talking about energy conservation. So I think that's where, I think that's where the line began to be drawn.
Science Friday host Ira Flatow is with us. And what does it mean that science has become so politicized, do you think? I mean, you've seen that over the course of your career happen.
Yeah. It means now that if I bring on the head of the science committee, let's say in Congress, it's very hard to get them to come on. Over the years, we're talking about money. And Congress appropriates money that gets shelled out to do a lot of basic research. Most of the basic research in this country is paid for by the federal government. And then companies will come in, take the basic research, and make technologies out of them. All the great cutting-edge basic research comes from the federal government. So if you have people in Congress who say, well, I don't believe in the science so much, let's not spend so much money on that basic research because I'm not a great believer in the science you're talking about, it's very difficult then to convince them that science is a legitimate thing to spend money on. And we've over the years, last few years, we've constantly tried to talk about that debate and bring on the head of the science committee, the science committee in Congress, and they've refused to come on. We actually did have him come on a few weeks ago and talk about some of the issues, but it was not easy.
We're talking to NPR's Ira Flatow and the show Science Friday and some of the guests that he's tried to get on unsuccessfully. I'm wondering, you know, should scientists themselves, have they played a role in this? Have they gotten too political? Should scientists themselves take political positions?
I think when they have taken political positions, and back in years ago when the environmental movement was just starting back in the late 60s and early 70s, where there were very many scientists, Barry Commoner, Paul Ehrlich, people like that, who were very out front giving their opinions about, in Paul Ehrlich's case, it was about the population bomb, population explosion. Barry Commoner was more about environmental movement things. They were very political and very outspoken about it. Scientists now are confronting a different issue, which is global warming. And a lot of them will tell you, you know, and as they have told me off the record, it's worse than I'm willing to tell the public. It's really, you know, almost reached a tipping point if we just, you know, do everything to stop emitting carbon, which we're not. Even now, we'd have to wait because the oceans would rise and the CO2 would continue to rise for a while. So some of them now are becoming more vocal. Jim Hansen, who was at NASA, he has left NASA and gone back to academia, and I think probably because it will allow him to legitimately become more vocal or to stay, you know, in the mix without having to say that he works for the federal government, without having that tie that he's a federal government scientist. So,
all right, and just beyond Congress in terms of this politicization, beyond the scientists, what about the public? What changes have you seen there? There's a lot of skepticism if you read the polls, especially towards something like global warming.
Well, I think we're seeing a paradigm shift on global warming. I think whereas the public was a little bit skeptical about whether it's happening, now it's getting hard to deny what your eyes show you. You see, the North Pole is free of ice in the summertime. They're creating shipping lanes there to carry freight. You know, when money gets involved, when the big money comes in, and that money means about fighting over the shipping lanes, the banks, Wall Street, whatever, if they're convinced that global warming is happening and they're going to stay ice-free, then you know that the paradigm has shifted a little bit.
So you feel like the public now is becoming a lot less skeptical. Studies show
that a majority of the public now believes in it and also wants the government to take some action about it.
I haven't seen the latest on something like evolution, but I mean, there's a significant percentage of the population that doesn't believe in something as basic as evolution. Yeah, I mean,
that hasn't changed since the Scopes trial.
Right.
You know, but I think what was interesting about that is that there was a judge in Pennsylvania who had a few years ago, when a test of evolution came up there, and he was a Republican judge appointed by Republican President George Bush. He ruled that this is really so silly a debate to have. And he looked through all the science that was presented about it, and he says, this is really so silly a debate. The science is so overwhelming, we shouldn't, you know, this is sort of silly, and threw it out. You know, it was a school board decision about teaching creationism in the classroom. So.
Science Friday, NPR host Ira Flatow is with us. We're talking about science and science policy and science education, really. My sense is that you face a little bit of an uphill battle, too, culturally, in terms of just how interested people are in science stories. I know you've got a great audience, but not everybody feels necessarily like they need to know how an electron works.
Well,
how do you make the case?
I don't have to make the case.
All right, okay. You deny that.
Well, I deny. Categorically deny that people do not like science. People love science. People love to talk about science if you present it to them in the way that they can understand it. That's the challenge. How do you not talk about little individual electrons, but you talk about the process? You talk about how it affects their lives, and you talk about the things that they are interested in, which science is interested in, like where we all came from and where we are all going, the basic tenets of theology, philosophy, and science, and what does the world look like in that structure. And science, people think that science is a big book. You have a big book on the table, we open the book, that's going to tell us what the truth is, you know? Science is a method. It's a method of finding out how nature works. And when you use that method, you know, there are certain experiments you do, observations that you do to test out your theories about how the world works. People love to talk about that stuff.
But what about you meet somebody and they say, you know, nature, it's not for me, not that interested. How do you convince somebody who's just not that interested in science to become interested in science?
Well, I haven't ever met anybody like that. I mean, I have met people who think they're not interested in science until you drill down and ask them, do you care where we came from? Do you wonder about what time is? Do you know that 97%, 96% of the universe, we don't know what it's made out of and we can't see it? Do you think that's kind of interesting? Do you think it's interesting that we might be able to cure diseases by injecting stem cells in them? We might be able to cure a heart attack by just giving you some stem cells and repairs the heart tissue. Does that interest you? When you break it down into all those kinds of things, people say, of course that interests me. It even interests conservatives who did not like science in Congress. When it affects their family, suddenly they start voting for the science that they never voted for before, because now they can see how that science could help cure somebody with a disease in their own family.
Science Friday host Ira Flatow is with us, and I'm wondering about kids. I've got a six-year-old, and how good of a job are we doing these days when it comes to science education at that level, K through 12?
Well, the challenge with kids are natural scientists. Your kid, I'm sure if you watch him, he's trying to probe everything, right? In the old days, they would take a Pop-Tart and stick it in the VCR, you know, trying to figure out, that fits in there. It sort of looks like a toaster hole, you know. We don't have VCRs anymore, so they find some other place to put it in. But kids are natural scientists. And the real challenge to us are two things. One is to keep these kids interested in science, and that requires good teachers. If you talk to or a good mentor, if you talk to people who are interested their whole life in science, whether they're Nobel Prize winners or what, chances are they'll tell you that somebody took them by the hand or took them aside as they were kids and showed them it was okay to be nerdy, okay to be interested in science, and it helped them through that stage, especially when you get to be teenagers, you know, and it doesn't look so much like it's good. Although today, the most popular show on CBS is The Big Bang Theory, a bunch of nerds, you know, sitting around talking like that. So there are these role models that kids can point to and say, look, I can be like that, making it a lot easier. And it also shows how popular science is. Why is that the most popular show, watching nerdy people talk about physics? Because the people are naturally interested in science. That's how I look at it.
Ira Flatow is with us. He's the host of Science Friday on NPR. And so what's your role in all of this? I mean, you've kind of described it already kind of indirectly, but what's your role as a science journalist?
Well, we just try to bring to life things you won't hear about in the news. You know, we go through journals and science stories every week, and there are thousands of them, and it's hard to eliminate them. Trying to do triage on a science story is very difficult. We know there is a great hunger and thirst out there. We also know there's a great mythology around the fact that people, the gatekeepers, do not think that people are interested in science. Well, we have our own gate now. We are a gatekeeper. Science Friday is a gate. And we can show, you know, we can bring that news to all of our listeners. And we have 2 million listeners a week, 1.5 million on the radio. We have another 500,000 podcasters. We do videos on our website. People are there. They're interacting. We have, you know, and they love to get as much as we can give them. And that proves to me that that there is real interest.
What do the scientists think? What do they think of you? What do they think of science journalists in general?
Well, there used to be many more science journalists than there are now. Science usually gets budget cuts when things happen. Yeah. Science is usually the first thing to get.
Hard to meet a science journalist.
It's hard. Well, there is a National Association of Science Writers, which has a couple of thousand members to it. But there used to be, a few dozen science sections in newspapers. Now maybe there's a handful of them. CNN fired its whole science staff when President Obama was first elected, almost about the same week. They fired Miles O'Brien and the whole science staff. He went to work at PBS, and they're gone. Thinking that, I guess, no one is interested in science. And now science, given all the issues that we're talking about all the time, is probably more relevant than it ever has. And there is more science going on. And we view ourselves as having a great niche that we don't have to do anything but present science and technology to the public. And there is no other place, you know, you can hear what we do and to listen to the kinds of stories we tell. And we're very, very happy about that.
But when you talk to scientists themselves, how do they react to the stories that you report?
Scientists are wary of reporters. They spend a lot of time trying to, you know, hone their skills. They don't speak very well, and they're not very good at speaking English to general assignment reporters. So the general assignment reporters may come away with the wrong idea, and they get very upset by that, and they get burned by that, and they will, maybe I won't talk to another reporter again. That's one of our advantages, is that we've been on the air 22 years. I've been doing this almost 40 years, and we have a long history of talking to of scientists. And scientists believe, the responsible scientists who do a lot of work, believe it is also part of their mission, because their money that they're using, as I say, is government money, is federal tax money, NIH, NSF, whatever, and they should have it as part of their mission to give back to the community and explain what they do. It also helps them get grant money when you know, time comes around again. And a lot of them realize that this is part of what they have to do, and it takes a certain talent to learn how to do that. And they do that. You know, Mary Claire King, who's, you know, at the forefront of the Supreme Court rulings right here in Seattle, and she's been talking to us for 20 years, and she'll be on our show tomorrow, and she'll be talking to us because she knows we respect her, and we know what she's doing, and she's not afraid to talk to us. So it, you know, it takes some experience to do this the right way.
All right, last question. Have to ask about Talk of the Nation and the future of Science Friday and your future, Bright?
We are just finished our first 22 years. We're in our first 22 years. We hope to be here another 22 years. We'll say teary goodbye to Talk of the Nation. We're going to be around. We'll be here as long as people are interested. We have no plans of going away. We may do more Science Friday. We might create a weekend version of Science Friday. So more and more people listen to us. Our numbers are not going down. We gain listeners. We create videos every week. We have hundreds of videos on our website. We're going to be creating more podcasts. People can stream us, listen to us, lots of different ways. And we're very happy that we're going to be right here until who knows when.
Great. All right. Well, thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Ira Flatow is the host of NPR's Science Friday from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm David Hyde.